For our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service now presents... The Indie Week. John Federson today for you, reading The Independent, a weekly edition, and today's issue is dated October the 16th of 2025. Before we start, I'd like to invite, solicit comments or questions about this particular broadcast, my reading of it, etc. I'll give you a phone number and a website in case. I have a specific reason for this, and I'll bring it up in just a moment. Here we go. And that reason is... For one, this is election season. The Independent is full of endorsements, backgrounds, and other articles, some of which I've read many of these issues already in previous weeks. I am today, because there's so much content in other areas as well, I have just 1 hour. I wish to abbreviate some of these articles, for example, the endorsements that the Independent is making for these offices, with and skip the voluminous commentary and questionnaires that accompany those. So this is an editorial decision made by me. Many of you, or some of you, may not like that. Many of you may want it that way. That lets me have access to more of the arts, entertainment, and other articles that are in the Indie Week. So the phone number for this station, as we always hear at the end of the day, is this, the following number. I'm going to give you 919-832-5138, 919-832-5138. There is an email for our director, Tara Racine, T-A-R-A, that's her name, at ncreadingservice.org. Tara at ncreadingservice.org. And please refer, if you want to make a comment about any of our shows or podcasts, this is what this is, a podcast, I would welcome them, she would welcome them, and I'll hear everything you have to say, positive or negative, about this show or me reading it and the decisions that I make. Specifically, though, are you comfortable with hearing fewer of background if some of that is being rehashed, in my opinion? Or do you want it as is, as written? And if some articles never get written, that's fine. So there's a kind of a choice. You can send to that to our director via email, or you can call that number. And please refer to Independent or Indie Week. That's the show you're now listening to, or will be as soon as I stop all this yammering and get to it. So let's get at it. So, as an example, the 2025 endorsements for Orange County municipal elections. This is a 6-page article, and including lots of different elections, and I'm going to cut to just a bare background of this article and the Indies endorsements. And this is what you'll hear from some other areas in this particular election season. Local governments have been dominated by two seemingly existential challenges, climate change and the economy. Then they talk about Tropical Storm Chantal, which destroyed a shopping center, and there's a mound of coal ash still sitting on Martin Luther King Boulevard, and Carrboro's public works facility destroyed, along with police cars, garbage trucks, and other town vehicles. At the same time, there's tougher-than-usual budget season, school board and town council trying to balance this funding. So these issues continue to dominate. And so here are our picks. Jess Anderson for Chapel Hill mayor is endorsed, and he's an incumbent, and he has got a second season. He's up for re-election. We found him to be open and accessible. We appreciate her policy chops and her clear vision for the council. That's just one vote of 9. And let's see. So we endorse Jess Anderson for the second term. How about the town council in Chapel Hill? There are four candidates: Camille Berry, Paris Miller Fouché, Louis Rivera, and Wes McMahon. All the candidates vying generally agree on issues, and they all bring relevant experience. So we were particularly impressed by Louis Rivera III and Wes McMahon, and endorsed them both. And there is McMahon, that is Wes McMahon, and he's endorsed as well. And they also say there's no reason not to vote for Eric Valera. We appreciate his nonprofit experience, but we have a difficult decision about whom to leave off. The experience of the incumbents and the climate and community focuses help push them to our top four spots. Carrboro Mayor, all but unopposed, Barbara Fouché, but they endorse her for a second term and three seats on the Carrboro Town Council. Danny Nowell, Cristobal Palmer are the endorsees for that. There is a third, Fred Joyner. There are three seats. He may get elected. I don't know. He is bringing commendable focus on arts and the time to his bid for a first term. We have too little information about his actual platform to issue that endorsement. They're not necessarily against the gentleman. So that's mayor and town council. Have I reached everything in that article? Yes, I have. So that was a four-page article, and I condensed that to about 2 minutes. Then there is a long article, very long, about breaking down the Chapel Hill Town Council race, and so I've precluded reading that to you in order just to give you the endorsements. Now, Cary, municipal elections are similar. There is a longish article about a nonpartisan town council, and the races are split along red and blue lines because Cary is more politically diverse now. And they divide the three races neatly along party lines, each featuring one Democrat, one Republican, all endorsed by their county party. So I could read that entire article, but I'm going to make the endorsement the key of this particular issue because voting is beginning. District A, Brittany Richards. In the 4 years she's lived in Cary, Brittany Richards has immersed herself in civic life as a member of Environmental Advisory Board, a precinct officer, and a volunteer for environmental causes. She's endorsed over Jennifer Robinson, her opponent, on the issues. She doesn't differ much. And Robinson has been a steady leader during 26 years on the council. But District A has grown in the last decade and now skews younger and more progressive. We think it would benefit from a fresh perspective, and for that reason, principally, it looks like they endorse Brittany Richards. Okay, so that's District C. Bella Huang leans older and more conservative compared to Cary at large. Two relative newcomers vie to replace Jack Smith. Neither candidate has held office before. Each has a history of political engagement that tells us a bit how they would approach the job. Her opponent, Renee Miller, ran for this seat and lost to Smith by a slim margin. That's Jack Smith, to say sweet. So the Indy endorses Bella Huang, H-U-A-N-G. There's an at-large seat. There's Carissa Cohn Johnson, focused on all the right priorities to suit the Indy Week. What really impresses us is her honesty. Her challenger, Marjorie Eastman, has an admirable record of public service as a U.S. Army combat veteran. Her unsuccessful campaign for U.S. Senate, she held her own on the Republican primary debate stage. We're not sure her defense expertise and focus on national politics lend themselves to town government. In any event, the Indy endorses Carissa Cohn Johnson for another term. That is Cary municipal elections. And thereby, I can forego the background article about all the issues in Kerry and the political climate therein. So, again, you're free. I solicit your comments and suggestions. Is this the wrong course, the right course? Are you comfortable with it? Let us know, please. Next, over to the city of Durham now, and now we are on civic affairs rather than the political. Well, everything's political. Central Durham bus rapid transit moves towards a 2032 opening. Durham City Council got an update last week on possible routes, funding, and implementation for Central Durham Bus Rapid Transit, BRT, project. I will say that this article online, where you can find it, you can find all the IndyWeek articles free on the IndyWeek's website, and they include links, which I can't give all the things that are linked to, and visual maps for those who can appreciate those, several different options, photographs, etc., but particularly maps. If that particularly interests you or you want to get make sure you get the whole story, go to IndyWeek.com and you'll find it. Okay, since announcing this project, the BRT, the Transportation Department has updated the proposal with suggestions for alternative routes around 9th Street on the west side and Holloway Street to the east that would provide the fastest, most efficient service for riders. The five-mile route would be a combination of existing Go Durham bus routes, providing public transit access to an estimated 50,000 residents commuting to and from an estimated 10,000 jobs, including major employers like Duke Hospital. Sean Egan, Durham's transportation director, told council members during their work session last Thursday that the proposed service also represents a critical link in the growing network of BRT projects throughout the Triangle. The design is expected to be finalized in 2029, with construction completed by 2031 and services running in 2032. Following a feasibility study, Transportation Department now estimates that the total cost from design to construction will be about $150 million, roughly $31 million per mile. To facilitate this bus system, the city will have to invest in new vehicles, upgraded stations, BRT priority lanes, and traffic signal configurations that keep the buses, well, rapid, as well as a major transit center at the Village Shopping District. The cost estimate also includes design and engineering needs. The project does qualify for funding from the Federal Transit Administration Small Starts Program, said Egan, which could cover up to 50% of the project costs. Transportation Department received letters of support from the North Carolina Department of Transportation, Duke University, and Go Triangle to bolster its bid for federal funding. The Central Durham BRT would run through much of Central Durham and link a number of destinations, including Duke Hospital and the Veterans Affairs Medical Center, Duke Central Campus, 9th Street, downtown Durham Station, the main library downtown, the Holton Career and Resource Center, and the Wellens Village Shopping Center in East Durham. Durham's population has grown by nearly 100,000 people in the last 25 years, bringing with it a higher volume of traffic for commuters to wrestle with and a need for alternative transportation options. Go Durham has seen a 42% increase in ridership just in the last 4 years, marking the highest ridership in the organization's history. But travel time is still a barrier for some looking to adopt public transit into their commuting routine. Respondents to a preliminary survey conducted by the Transport Department emphasized a strong desire for 7 to 10 minute travel times, real-time tracking of vehicles, and signal priority for buses, all to improve speed and reliability. In addition to the city's central BRT plan, Durham County is taking a long-range look at developing other potential corridors for BRT level service. Improvements to local bus service were priorities identified in the 2023 Durham Transit Plan. That plan's development and implementation are funded by the half-cent transit sales tax that was passed back in 2011. Both city and county, it closes, are taking community input on their bus rapid transit plans. And this article provides a link, which my printout does not show, but you can find it if you want to comment on these bus rapid transit plans. And it would, even though the design, the finish of the design is years in the future, the planning has to take place and be in place much sooner than that. And moving on, this is the Durham Rail Trail. This is not a car or bus issue. I'm sure it's a hiking and bicycle. More than 7 years after Durham bought an inactive rail corridor with plans of turning it into a trail, the Durham Rail Trail is in its final stages of design. City Council heard a presentation during Thursday work session on the project timeline and amenities and public art that will be found along this 1.8-mile trail. Construction is set to begin January 2027, with the trail opening to the public in 2028. The trail, from according to the city's website, will run from, quote, the area around Avondale Drive and Trinity Avenue to just northeast of the Durham Amtrak station at West Chapel Hill Street, forming a crescent around downtown Durham. That project is projected to cost $45.5 million. The rail trail is 20 years in the making, something Councillor Carl Rist is mindful of. He said during the work session, "I think it's pretty clear we were here about a year ago. Since then, the timeline's also been pushed back another year, so we've got to deliver this thing. We've got to do it soon." Since the schedule for the project was presented to the council last year, the timeline was pushed back 6 to 9 months to further evaluate costs and ensure they remain within the budget, said Henry Prosperi, the city's project management division manager. The trail is slated to submit 90% complete designs to the NC State Department of Transportation in March of next year. It will incorporate Durham's goal of creating renewable energy in city operations through creating a 52% increase in households with access to a park by bike or foot, said Iona Thomas, Chief Growth and Strategy Officer for McAdams. That's a planning, design, and engineering firm. "This is only one item that's designed to attract residents," she said. Sitting alongside the trail downtown, a proposed gateway plaza will include micro-retail, a flexible plaza space, native plants, and public art. The plaza would be located between the Durham Amtrak station and the downtown loop, where there is currently a gravel lot. That plaza would serve as a connection between the Durham bus station and downtown, which is slated for several redevelopment projects in the coming years. It will also connect to the Ellerby watershed near Trinity Avenue. Public art for this trail will include the Stagville Memorial Project. That's a nod to the more than 900 people who were enslaved at the Stagville Plantation between 1771 and 1865. Councillor Chelsea Cook said she has some concerns the rail trail could lead to gentrification or other unintended effects on residents near the route. Quote, "I do want to ensure we are working on, as we're working, we're thinking about the real impacts on people who actually live in Durham and whether we're building a place for those folks or building a place for others we'd like to displace them with," she said. Nia Rogers, a project manager for McAdams who has been involved with this since 2017, said many low-income residents were already gone By the time her team canvassed the surrounding neighborhoods several years ago, Rogers said the train may have already left the station. She had helped draft the project's equitable engagement blueprint and knocked on doors when it was time for community input. Quote, but it doesn't mean that we can't change things. The rail trail was formerly named the Durham Belt Line, which drew inspiration from the Atlanta Belt Line, which is a 22-mile trail. The trail in Georgia's capital has caused property values to soar and residents to be displaced, generating concerns of gentrification. Councilmember Mark Anthony Middleton said it's never excessive to talk about equity in Durham, but the city is, quote, so committed to the equity piece of the trail that the timeline has lagged partially because of community engagement. And he said, I think the prominent place of Stagville in this project is a direct result of our equitable engagement to make sure all the voices, colors, and stripes of Durham are prominently. Perhaps the most prominent place along this trail has been left to the descendants of those that were formerly enslaved. That is because we spoke to the community. All right, here's Indy Selects What to Do in the Triangle this week from amongst voluminous calendar of various items, musical, visual, entertainment-wise, theatrical. They picked something for maybe six or seven things to do this week in the entire triangle. And the first thing, it's the editors who picked this out. To do, that is today, October the 16th, 4 to 6 p.m. at Durham Station in Durham. Durham Arteries, a free portrait photography and mapping event, is hosted by the city as part of its Durham Cultural Roadmap Initiative. It's a pop-up event. It's dubbed the Department of Make-Believe, and it's hosted by Monet Noel Marshall and R. Stein Wexler, two local artists who have led the public engagement process in the city's effort to propel the arts forward. If you want to have a say in future local cultural programming and how the city imagines the arts going forward, this event is a key opportunity to make your voice heard and discuss the roadmap. So that is at Durham Station in downtown Durham, 4 to 6 p.m. today. And there's no nothing about having to register or anything. You could just show up. All right. And then Saturday night, let's see, when I said today, I now realize belatedly that I'm recording this on Thursday, but you won't hear it till Friday, so you can forget the Durham Station one. It wasn't available to me last week to read. It's just an unfortunate scheduling about this podcast. However, I do have some real event that's still in the future, time travel. Saturday, the 18th of October, 3:30 to 6:30 p.m. at West Point on the Eno, Hallow Eno. It's the 37th annual Hallow Eno. Get it? It's a perfect mid-autumn event for families, especially those with young children. Access to the river began reopening in September following this flooding. It's at the west point of the Eno, which has reopened, though riverbank access is still closed. The event will have campfire stories complete with a campfire, as well as food trucks, drinks, and treats. I can't promise they will tell them, but I was deeply creeped out by stories about the Wendigo at Eno Summer Camp as a child. The event will also feature crafts and games. Saturday, the 18th, at 3:30 to 6:30 at West Point on the Eno. Okay, also, starting at noon on Saturday, the Nasher Museum of Art in Durham, and that's near Duke Gardens. It starts at noon, October the 18th. It's their 20th anniversary. It's been a cultural cornerstone in Durham and a national leader among museums championing minority voices. To mark 20 years, the museum is holding a grand opening for a new sculpture garden along a slate of programming that kicks off at noon with the ANSI Central Sound Machine Drumline and continues through the afternoon with screen printing class, poetry, drag story hour, photo booths, and numerous other activities that draw in other local institutions from Scrap Exchange to the Museum of Life and Science. Don't miss a sensory observation tour of nearby Duke Gardens at 3 p.m. October 18th. The afternoon closes off with a 5 p.m. performance from Ninth Wonder. Parking is free. Check out the Nasher Museum website for more details. Finally, I'm going to read probably an interview with this gentleman. Gene Nichols presents Now What? How North Carolina Can Blaze a Progressive Path Forward. The aftermath of the 2024 election cycle left good and bad news for progressives. Commentator Gene Nichols tackles in his latest book, What Now What? With Democratic wins in state leadership but a victory for Trump, Nichols writes to progressives who have political energy and no place to put it. His book shares his insights into how progressives can, quote, move the state forward, tackling the opposition and their own flagging spirits. There will be room here at this presentation at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. That's Tuesday, October the 21st, Flyleaf Books at 6 p.m. There will be room for up to 70 guests, but priority will go to those who have purchased a book. At checkout, indicate in the customer comments section if you would like a seat saved. So you go to Flyleaf Books, indicate in customer comments if you want a seat saved for you of these 70 seats for Gene Nichols' book. We'll hear more about that book in an interview with him momentarily. And here it is. In a political era where many Democrats feel disheartened, shell-shocked, and numb to the parade of dictatorial edicts handed down by Trump during his second term, commenter and constitutional scholar Gene Nichols asks a question we've all dwelled on, now what? His answer is simple, but not easy. We fight. He says, the writer says, for people like me who grew up imagining they would inherit a bright liberal future replete with equal rights and politicians willing to dramatically improve education, give people a way out of poverty, and repair the damage of climate change, this is perhaps not the answer we want to hear. But as Nichols, a longtime North Carolinian, incisively points out in his examination of the state's cyclical history of progress and pushback, it's the only answer there is. In a southern state with a long history of racial violence, it's past time to accept that we're not always a beacon of progress we wish to be, he argues. But there's still a place for optimism, even if it's now a rare commodity, he writes on that same page. As much as North Carolina is a state of regressive conservatism, it's also a state with a rich legacy of protest with North Carolina progressives carrying an ever-ready willingness to fight for their state's future, he writes. He finds hope in our election of Democrats in the statewide races, where ruthlessly gerrymandered political districts could hold no sway. He finds hope in the widespread protests that erupted when Judge Jefferson Griffin attempted to steal a seat on the North Carolina Supreme Court. And somewhat counterintuitively finds hope in the fact that Republicans have had to obfuscate their true motives in order to lower taxes for the wealthy, take funding from public schools, and target civil rights. As in his previous books, 2023's Lessons from North Carolina, Nichols takes advantage of his deep knowledge of state politics to pull back the curtain on Republican machinations pointing to clear evidence that GOP leaders have waged an enthusiastic and relentless war on democratic processes since 2010. Even the most political, knowledgeable, and engaged reader will learn something surprising and important about what the North Carolina General Assembly has been up to in the last 25 years. He's not afraid to use strong language, calling Phil Berger, Tim Moore, Jefferson Griffin, and the Republican contingent of the North Carolina Supreme Court crooks, liars, and thieves, while making a convincing case that brutal honesty is what's needed among Democrats if they want to mobilize voters. The state's more mannerly anti-democratic crusade is in direct contrast to Trump's blatant attacks on democracy. Nickel writes, but in 2025, he argues, the GOP has gone public, and it's time we do the same. Stop pretending we're on an equal playing field. Stop pretending it's just politics as usual. Stop pretending we don't have an obligation to fight for democratic values. He presents a suite of ambitious state constitutional amendments he argues Democrats should aggressively back, similar to some enacted in other states, the most important of which is an amendment to create an independent redistricting commission. With victories in the 2026 and 28 elections, he argues a referendum that puts power back in the hands of the people is possible, and grassroots action is key. Finally, he writes, the last 15 years have shown that victories won't always readily come. Sometimes we'll lose and lose again. We'll discover that part of our charge, almost the most essential part, is that we not lose heart. Getting up off the mat can be the engaged citizen's greatest attribute. All right, I'm going to read a review or a paper, an article about the Burning Coal Theater in Raleigh and their production of My Name is Rachel Corrie, readings across 10 months. A few pages into the script of My Name is Rachel Corrie, that's a play drawn from the writings of the young American activist crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer in 2003, the titular character meditates on the urban journey of salmon. Corrie writes how she learned that salmon sometimes find their way into underground channels in her home of the Pacific Northwest, where they must struggle upstream. The salmon talked me into a lifestyle change, she writes. Once you know there are salmon down there, it's hard to forget. You imagine their moony eyes while you walk home from a bar in your slutty boots. It's hard to be extraordinarily vacuous when you always have the salmon in the back of your mind in that pipe down there on their way to daylight at Watershed Park. Passages like this position Corrie as both a gifted writer and a young person with a remarkable capacity for empathy. At the time of her death, she was standing in front of a Palestinian home trying to protect it from being demolished. That house was one of 3,000 Palestinian homes destroyed by Israeli forces between 2001 and 2003. A January 2025 report from Doctors Without Borders found that 92% of housing units in Gaza had been destroyed by Israeli forces, alongside more than 1,000 structures destroyed in the West Bank, according to a United Nations report. In September, Burning Coal Theater launched a special series of 10 staged readings spanning 10 months of My Name is Rachel Corrie. The next reading is October 15th. Check the website for the full schedule. Now, folks, I'm going to present this website to you at the end of reading this article. Jeff Zinn, the director of the series, says, I think she had a career in front of her, whether it would have been journalism or fiction or, you know, who knows? I mean, she was 23, for God's sake. When she died, she had her whole life ahead of her. The play was written by one of my favorite actors, Alan Rickman, the late actor, and journalist Catherine Viner, drawing text directly from 184 pages of Corey's emails and diaries, and premiered at London's Royal Court Theatre back in 2005. Formatted as a one-person play, this rendition engages multiple cohorts of readers. The first production was done by local artistic directors. A January reading will feature military members. Events are free with a suggested donation of $10, with all proceeds going to Doctors Without Borders and other international aid organizations working in Gaza. That's from the Burning Coal website. Rachel Corey's parents, who have been outspoken activists in the wake of their daughter's death 2 decades ago, are expected to attend one of the readings this year. Since her death, she's often been venerated as a kind of modern-day saint. Throughout My Name is Rachel Corey, though, her words anchor her in earthly dimensions as a person with strong moral convictions, normal 20-something instincts, and perhaps the occasional penchant for being overly flowery. Her character rattles off idiosyncratic lists, debates with her parents, and earnestly describes what she sees around her. At one point, she tells her parents in an email, "I still really want to dance around to Pat Benatar and have boyfriends and make comics for my co-workers." At another, she writes of Israel's occupation of Palestine, "I can't believe that something like this can happen in the world without a bigger outcry. I think it's a good idea for us all to drop everything and devote our lives to making this stop." Jerome Davis, artistic director at Burning Coal, says he felt moved to put the production on after watching the massive humanitarian crisis caused by Israel's offensive on Gaza, saying, "I just wanted to do something, and I just felt like this would be a good way to give people the chance to do it with me. You know, not just post something online, right?" Zinn, former artistic director of the celebrated Wellfleet Harbor Actors Theater on Cape Cod, echoes similar thoughts. "The conditions in Gaza now are so much worse than they were when she was there. I don't think a Rachel Corey would even be allowed to insert herself in the middle of the situation in Gaza today." "I think Davis is very brave to do this now," Zinn continues, "because I can only imagine he'll be drawing fire for producing it, and to do it in such a high-profile way, to not do it just once, but again and again and again and again. I think that's incredibly brave." While Triangle locals have multiple choices to see this play, reading My Name is Rachel Corey initially had a bumpy road reaching American audiences. In 2006, following 2 sold-out runs in London, the play was scheduled to premiere at New York Theatre Workshop. Opening night never happened. Several weeks before the premiere, the theatre got cold feet and postponed the play, citing the need for more contextualizing of the material, a move that drew criticism from the likes of Tony Kushner and Vanessa Redgrave. More cancellations across the country followed, and even when the play did open, it's painful to read the sneering words from American reviewers. One from New Yorker critic John Lahr described Corey at once as manipulative and porous, a vessel for the projections of others. Had no one ever met a headstrong 20-something? On the flip side, a groundswell of readings arose in protest of a cancellation that many felt was political censorship. Years later, the play has been staged many times internationally, including a previous run at Burning Coal, and Corey's words still feel electric, as if they could have been written yesterday. The suffering that she touches on predates the war and famine happening today, the atrocities of October 7th, and even the election of Hamas, which occurred 3 years after her death. They also predate the ceasefire deal between Hamas and Israel, signed into place on October the 9th. As both a portrait of an idealistic young woman and a snapshot of horrific international conflict, these readings are well worth making time for. One takes away from Corey's writing a renewed desire to better consider the lives of others and the ripple effects of individual things, jobs, Amazon purchases, tax dollars that we participate in, to imagine maybe salmon swimming beneath us. So, my name is Rachel Corey. As I'm going to present the schedule now of this. Let's see, select the date you understand. There was one yesterday, that is to say Wednesday, October 15th. So there's one about in every month. Wednesday, November 19th. Wednesday, December 10th. Wednesday, January 7th, 2026. February 11th, Wednesdays are Wednesdays. March 18th, April 15th, income tax. May 20th and June 17th. All of these Wednesday performances of readings of My Name is Rachel Corey, written by Alan Rickman and Karen Wiener in 2005. And that concludes that article. Next, I have time for a long interview with Solomon Fox, IRL, music multi-instrumentalist and producer based in Los Angeles. It's late August, and the L.A.-based multi-instrumentalist and producer Solomon Fox, one of the most talented musicians to come out of Durham since his own brother Elijah a few years before him, is less than 2 months away from releasing the second solo album of his career, his first since 2021. One can imagine, based on that alone, how much there is for us to discuss, from influences and sound to the motivating spirit behind this release, and at various points of our conversation, we do. But in the back corner of Bon's Cuisine, amid the low din of the back-to-school Duke student lunch crowd, we're spending just as much time talking about a lesser-known aspect of his professional oeuvre, dedicated, stressed-out impresario of organic, do-it-yourself music festivals. Let's see. He explains of his first such endeavor, 818 Fest, F-E-S-T, which took place for 4 years on the family property along the coast of Virginia. A bunch of people would come, some people would camp, but it sort of got out of control. There was one year where people were doing heroin. Somebody vomited in the printer. One guy stole another guy's shoes and threw them in the Chesapeake Bay. At 818 Fest, perhaps for its own good, no longer exists. And yet, its intrepid creator remains unbowed. The day after we met up in Durham, Fox is headed to Southern Virginia for a sprawling 80-acre farm that he and a group of childhood friends purchased during the pandemic for the third year of Grouse Fest, a friend of friends weekend gathering animated by the same passion for community and creativity as the debauchery-laden predecessor. Fox says, it's just so much more natural to me than any other setting. It's the same thing I feel about shows. I love just experience that feels super intimate musically. And this is one of the most intimate because it's just so uncorporate. Now that Fox, who was born by the name Gabe Fox-Peck, would have an affinity for the raw and unembellished makes sense for someone whose musical origins are about as earnest and no frills as it gets. Learning piano at home alongside his musically gifted older brother, then starting a high school band called simply Tamik and Gabe, later Young Bull, with Mike Cameron, that was born out of a spur-of-the-moment joint performance in the school talent show. He placed third. Now, years removed from Young Bull's late 2010s height of activity, Fox's horizons have continued to expand and his profile grown on the strength of work like the Grammy and Oscar-nominated song Stand Up from the film Harriet, production for acts like Smino and Emmeline, and his own solo singles like the transfixing 2023 ballad Stay. There's one other important detail to his recent history, too, a series of bizarro social media music videos from last year, featuring a totally deadpan, expressionless Fox looking straight into the camera and singing about the awkwardness of parties, struggles with punctuality, and the definition of cooking as he rips through every part of the song's dazzling instrumentation all by himself. viewed millions of times and co-signed by the likes of Erica Badu, Jill Scott, and Ty Dolla $ign, and even leading to a remix of the State Farm jingle, there's little doubt that as Fox heads into the release of Sweet Tooth on October 9th, the videos are responsible for a larger share of his public recognition than anything else. That's fine with him, as long as it gets people to actually connect with the artistry behind them, and meme music isn't what he's remembered for overall. He says, I definitely think of those as little hooks to bring people into the bigger universe. I do enjoy goofing off, and that was part of what made these so fun, but I also have this other music. Across the baker's dozen of groovy, glittering, fully formed tracks on Sweet Tooth, that much is obvious, as is the single-minded persistence and knack for playful ingenuity that makes his many avenues expression, from vile Instagram videos, viral Instagram videos, to no marketing farm festivals, it feels like one coherent whole. So he returns to Durham to play at the Pinhook coming up on November 9th this year. November 9th. So, question and answer. You've been making music professionally, including Oscar and Grammy nominations for a while now, but what really introduced you to a lot more people were the viral videos last year. What got you started doing that in the first place? What were you expecting with it? The previous year, answer, I had put out some music. This was 22-23. I was mostly just working with other people and producing, but I was trying to put some stuff out here and there and just see what was happening next. And my manager at the time, which was kind of the classic thing for a lot of people, was just saying, post on TikTok every day, every day. I was trying to do that, and it wasn't hitting. I was doing dumb little skits. I wasn't enjoying it. It was clear that I was doing it to get attention. It just feels so cringy to me when you're trying to get attention. So I just didn't really follow the advice for a long time. And before I had those things go viral, I hadn't posted for 6 months. I'd mostly abandoned it. Then randomly, I just made this dumb, jokey thing that even if I was doing it, I was like, this is so stupid. But it was funny. It was genuinely amusing to you. Yeah. It was music that I'd made and I clearly wanted to be doing, and I didn't mean for it to go anywhere. It wasn't heady. I was just having fun with it and showing my actual personality and instead of trying to take myself too seriously. Was it one of the first ones you posted that went crazy, or they slowly got bigger and bigger over time? The first time it went pretty crazy. That was the song You Don't Cook, which was actually about my friend Anna. She's always making these pre-made meals. She'll be like, I'm cooking this meal. And I'm like, you're not cooking. You're heating up some Trader Joe's shit. And so then I was just taunting her a little bit, loving taunting. It did well initially, and then it just kept going up, and I was like, holy shit, I've never had anything go viral really before. When that starts to happen, the interviewer says, I think even on a smaller scale, lots of people run into this with social media. It can suck you into spending more time doing it, or even subconsciously have you thinking about when you're doing something else. Do you have to consciously pull yourself away from the temptation of making more content and be like, no, I want to be a musician? Yeah, I still think about it. It's definitely a struggle. I'm grateful for people who enjoy what I'm doing, but I definitely think of those as little hooks to bring people into the bigger universe. I enjoy goofing off. That was part of what made these so fun. But I also have this other music. Yeah, you don't want that to become your career. No, not at all. I don't listen to any joke music personally, so it's like, what am I going to be? Weird Al Yankovic? No shade to that. I mean, that's cool. He did his thing, I guess. But that's not the music I want to make. And maybe this is egotistic, but there's been some other people copying my style or just the deadpan looking angry and playing. Do people tell you about that, or does it just literally come across your feed? People will tag me in it. People will be like, this is Solomon Fox's shit. I would never tell someone to do that, but every time it happens, I'm like, I hate this. I don't want this to be the thing I'm known for, you know? Have you noticed that being the hook that you want it to be, has it helped people get into the actual music and open up opportunities? For sure. It also helped me realize what my strengths are. I don't want to go only into meme music, which would be the most negative way to put that, but at the same time, I do realize in my previous album, Solomon, there's not a single solo on the whole album, and it's like, if you've ever seen me play live, I'm taking solos. That's a primary form of my voice musically. So that was the positive thing from the videos I was seeing. Oh, this is what works. This is what people react to. So kind of blending those worlds has been what led me to the place where I'm at now, where there's a lot of intimate moments, but there's also some fun moments that are kind of, I don't know the right word, sly or whatever. Before Solomon Fox, your career started in Durham with a hip-hop R&B Young Bull. How did the group come about? How did it impact your career before you moved out to L.A.? It was massive. I was so blessed to be a part of that, honestly. It started with me and Mike, that is Tamik Cameron, meeting on the Durham School of the Arts JV basketball team, and that was probably 2013. We were sophomores in high school. It almost sounds like it was from a movie, but it was a talent show, and it was run by the math teacher, Mr. Maltzby. We both didn't sign up in advance. There was an audition for it after school, and it was me and Miki. But there was only one slot left, and Mr. Maltzby was like, you guys can decide between you who wants to do it, or you guys can do it together. At that point, we'd never done any music together. We were both just like, well, what songs do you know? What do you know? We both knew Ordinary People by John Legend. We didn't win the talent show, but we got third place. I started going back to my house after basketball practice. I lived a block from School of the Arts and recording. At that point, I was writing and producing stuff, but I was just doing it myself in my room. The first song we made was Can't Get You Out of My Head, which I was like, here, you sing those words instead of me. And that was the beginning of our thing. We posted on SoundCloud, and I remember it got 1,000 plays in the first week or month. Do you just feel like it was just randos, or were there a lot of kids in school that liked it? It was kids in school, and then they would send it to their friends. When we did our first show at the Shed in Golden Belt, it was all kids from high school. We didn't even have the name Young Bull yet. It was just Tamik and Gabe. We actually started picking up more once I went to college my freshman year. We just kept growing it. Then we finished that album, Soapadelic. The summer after my freshman year, we also added Christian Sinclair to the ranks, and then the next summer we did some touring. It was so great. It was such a fun time. The musicians were so dear to me and still are, and I learned so much about writing and producing. We've been laying low, but we have a whole project, basically, that we've been working on slowly for the last 4 or 5 years, so that'll come out next year. Crisis produced on it, too, another Triangle legend, as well as some other folks. But yeah, it's been, we had a project ready to go, then we split ways with Christian, and so we kind of had to start over. Your brother is also an insane multi-instrumentalist and producer in his own right. Drake, Kali Uchis, SZA, and Denzel Curry. As the older sibling, it seems his journey has always been a few steps ahead, but now y'all are increasingly on a similar plane and sharing the same spaces. Is that something y'all talk about? Like how you wanted to do this and now it's happening? Totally. I mean, this was always our dream when we were kids making up songs in our parents' house. It never felt like it was possible. It's just something sort of happened, which is crazy. It doesn't feel real. But we don't really talk about it that much. We both are just kind of onto the next a lot of the time. So we don't necessarily reflect a lot. We'll have moments that are just really like, whoa, bro, we really made it. We're here. I can't believe this is happening. It's also definitely felt nice in the last couple of years to be like, I can do this too in my own way, and it's not just Elijah's brother. Was it that way for a period of time? Definitely for a while, meeting people in LA, just being in situations where it's like, I'm known primarily as his brother. I could always hold my own. That was never the issue. It was more so that's just how he was known. And it was like, damn, both of them can play. What the hell? I mean, maybe there were times I fucked up the vibe, but very rarely. He was always very generous with bringing me to stuff. But yeah, it was important for independence to do my own path, my own trail. You've had a solo album before, but I imagine one of the things about this, given all the production work you've been doing for others, is stepping out of that into that spotlight again as the front-facing leader of something. How do you feel about that, going into this rollout? Yeah, it feels really, really exciting. Definitely a little scary. It's a lot more pressure. I'm definitely a creature of comfort. I wear lots of hats. So sometimes my fear of being the center of attention can mean me to run between different stuff and sort of keep avoiding that. So this is kind of me facing my fear a little bit, but it's so rewarding. Feeling of hearing people sing along to a song you wrote. There's nothing in my life that's ever compared to that. And not in an ego way, just in a, I did something and now it's bigger than me. You know what I mean? And that feeling is so nice. So it's more pressure, but also more rewarding. So because of time, I have to omit now about a page of this long, long interview. And I will cut to the very end of it. You love putting on these do-it-yourself festivals, the interviewer says. Yes, yeah, I mean, it's the best. It's just so much more natural to me than any other setting. It's the same thing I feel about shows. I just love experiences that feel super intimate musically. And it's just one of the most intimate because it's so uncorporate. For some people, I could see how there might be a desire, given how everyone has loved it so much, to make it a bigger thing, but it sounds like you wouldn't want to ever make it something like that. The whole point is how lo-fi it is. Exactly. We're not trying to blow it up. I mean, there's a part of me that thinks it could be profitable, but it's not our main interest. And it's almost become a friend reunion, too, in a lot of ways. There's a lot of people that I'll see there I haven't seen since the last one we did. There's a very home community feel about it, which is nice. I'm not just that interested in the business side of music. Well, folks, I must call it quits now. I'll just give you that phone number again for North Carolina Reading Service, 919-832-5138, or my boss's email, Tara, T-A-R-A, at ncreadingservice.org. And please comment on the things that I mentioned earlier, any changes you'd like to see in this broadcast or podcast. John Federson now for Independent, the Indie Week, saying so long. I'll be with you again next week. Thank you.